Thank you. May it please the court, again, my name is James Mello. I represent the plaintiffs, taxpayers of the City of Herman in this Hancock Amendment action against the city. This court's holding in Keller and Zahner is and should remain good law. Both Zahner and Keller articulate solid public policy and give clear instruction in its holding to local governments who are earnestly attempting to comply with the Hancock Amendment. The essence of Keller is found, in my opinion, is captured in a quote by Deep Throat in All the President's Men, "Follow the money." If a local government increases its charges or fees, follow the money. If the increase in the fees and charges is being used to compensate for the cost of the services being provided directly to the taxpayer for those fees, then that charge, that increase in charge, is probably going to be a true user fee and probably not ordinarily going to be subject to the Hancock Amendment. But if the increase in that revenue that's generated by the increase in the charge for that fee, for that service is being diverted to the city's general fund, are being used to defray other costs of local government, are being transferred to funds unrelated, for use unrelated, to the purpose of that user charge, that increase is subject to the Hancock Amendment.
Mr. Mellon, when we talk about the five factors and following the money, that sounds a lot like fact-finding to me, that we will have a number of facts introduced into evidence and there will have to be a determination of where the money went, how much money, what would have been money that would have been reasonable for the running of the utility, but wouldn't, right?
Well, Your Honor, I would answer the question in a couple different ways.
Okay.
The first answer I would give is that yes, it is a fact inquiry because you have to look at the nature of the tax and the essence of that imposition. But I don't think it's a hard task to perform, and I don't think it's subject to what I consider to be a sophomoric attempt at trying to articulate factors which belay the local government's ability.
Yeah, I'm getting even before
that.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
It's just that this is a fact-finding endeavor.
Yes.
Who is the entity that finds the facts? Is it a judge?
The trier of fact.
Who is the trier of fact? The judge here. You're not arguing a right to a jury trial.
No.
In this case, we had a judge who evaluated facts and entered a summary judgment.
Yes, but I'm sorry.
Yeah, and so the nature of my question is, what more would have happened but for the summary of judgment, since the judge already finds the facts?
Because his facts were applied to footnote 10 of a decision and not to the essence or the holding in that decision. None of those factors...
Talking about Keller? Footnote 10?
Footnote 10 in Keller. None of those factors ask the question of where the money went. The essence of Keller is where does the money go? The Keller factors might be some kind of a guide, might be helpful in certain circumstances, but when you're talking about a general government of a city and the monies are being transferred to the general fund and being used for purposes other than what the user charge was imposed upon, to me, you don't need to go deeper and look at the facts.
If the municipal swimming pool is selling soda for a dollar that it pays 50 cents for, is the extra 50 cents a fee, a tax, subject to the Hancock Amendment?
It's a fee, but it's not subject to the Hancock Amendment because it's not being provided for an essential service. It's not being imposed by the local government on the consumer.
But it's not required that a person who lives in the city of Herman buy electricity from the city, is it?
No, it's not, Your Honor. And if this court decides that the purchase of electricity and purchase of natural gas and water and sewer in an urban environment is a discretionary service that is not imposed upon them by the government, if they're the owner of those utilities, then I would submit that we're done. Because what you're suggesting is, the argument is that somehow a citizen in Herman doesn't have to be part of the electric grid in this day and age. I think that's a totally unpersuasive argument. What we're talking about, and again, what the Attorney General stated was he tried to make a distinction between market-driven charges or charges that basically there's no practical alternative but to pay. I think that the Keller
is there
analysis,
any comparison to what these consumers pay in Herman versus what they what consumers of Ameren UE outside of the city of Herman pay? Are the rates the same or the lower in the city?
No, Your Honor, that is not a Hancock question.
I know it's not a Hancock question. I was just wondering what the, you know, because you're really dealing in an energy marketplace. I mean, I don't think the average consumer thinks of it that way, but I could put solar stuff up on my roof and not buy anything from the city of Herman, couldn't I?
Well, yeah, except when the sun doesn't shine and you're not on the grid.
Well, I'd have to have some pretty dang big batteries in my basement.
My point, I don't have to buy a car, and I don't have to pay personal property tax.
Right.
I don't have to consume anything, and I don't have to pay sales taxes. The point is that these are essential services, and it's an imposition on the consumers.
Where does Hancock Amendment draw this distinction you're asking us to draw? Where can we find the language in the Hancock Amendment that draws the distinction between what is effectively some sort of utility service has to be provided to nearly all residents versus you're saying there's a difference if there's a choice to make use of a service?
Well, I think, again, in some instances that could be a fact inquiry, because in certain jurisdictions, you know, if a certain service is not available except from the government, then it might be more essential than.
Say you had two natural gas providers in Herman. Would that mean that it was not, or you had a choice of Ameren or something else? And I know we don't here. Yeah. I'm trying to figure out what the extent is of how to apply your argument and how it might apply if we were to adopt it in other situations. Do we sit there and decide if there's real competition or not competition? Does that end up being our inquiry?
Well, I think the inquiry is easy in this case, because here we're talking about utilities that the city has a monopoly. They're the only provider of those services.
I understand, but you're asking us to adopt a rule and a distinction that will have to be applied in multiple cases, so how would that apply?
If I was to suggest a rule in other cases, I would say that it would be based on the free market give and take under the circumstances. In other words, I don't have to buy that soda at the baseball game. I can bring water. I don't have to go to the swimming pool. I've got alternatives. If I don't have a practical alternative, then to me that's an imposition. That's the levy. That's the imposition, something I'm being required to purchase. And again, it's ironic that we're making those distinctions today in the year 2010. Before 1980, before the Hancock Amendment, cities had utilities. They operated those utilities and by the local government. The Board of Aldermen set the rates up or down depending on what they want to do. They covered all the costs of providing that service, the cost of the service, setting aside reserves, and all those elements. They even added what would be considered a profit component, a payment in lieu of taxes. Those were part of the rate structures before 1980. What happened in 1980? The Hancock Amendment changed the rules with respect to the profit component of the rate, to the tax rate that was being imposed by the city.
I want to ask you a question there. When you say they changed the rules regarding the profit portion or the return on investment, and as a part of having an electrical utility service to the city, there'd have to be some retained capital, but there'd have to be some return on that, all of those things. And those would be fact issues, wouldn't they?
Yes, but take the Pace case in Hannibal or the Columbia case, which was not a Hancock case, but I think it's very instructive. Both of those cities had a pilot payment as part of their rates prior to 1980 at 5.5% in the case of Hannibal. Keller doesn't disturb that. The same thing with the City of Columbia. They had a 7% pilot payment. Doesn't disturb that. The only time that the Hancock Amendment's invoked, if you want to raise that percentage, you want to raise, if you will, your sales tax on that unit.
When you look at raising that, though, would you also look at market forces? What are neighboring communities charging for their electricity? Why wouldn't that be a normal thing to look at to see what a normal profit would be if we're following the money, money that should stay here, money that is diverted to the city?
Because they're not subject to the Public Service Commission in determining what's a fair rate of return. That's between them and the voters. If they want to raise their profit margin, they're free to do so. They're one vote away from doing it. If in the case of
why can't they just vote out the guys that raise their rates?
I beg your pardon?
Isn't the answer for that they vote out the aldermen who raise the rates?
Well, that would be the case, except that we have it's embodied. The Hancock Amendment is embodied in the Constitution of the State of Missouri, and so it's not enough to say, well, if Herman wants to do it, let that be a judgment of the City of Herman. That's fine and good. And if the aldermen are acting in a way that meets with the approval of the citizens of Herman, there's no issue there. Just if you want to increase your, if you want to take your gas utility and take it from a zero pilot payment, which was in effect in 1980, the facts clearly show on the record, and go to 10%, there's no Hancock argument. You just have to put it to a vote of the people. And if the people approve it, you're fine.
Mr. Mello, I noticed in your briefs that you're pretty critical of the Keller factors. In fact, I think on one of the pages of your brief, you called it dicta. But in fact, though, would you agree or not that the cases have been pretty consistent interpreting those factors in that the cases where they found that the utility charges or similar charges are taxes in every way but name only, they have been flat rate type cases. And so in fact, the what's gone through this line of cases, what's consistent in the line of cases is the idea that if the utility is just charging for what is being used, that the Hancock Amendment doesn't apply. What do you think about that? Do you think those cases are consistent or not?
I do not think they're consistent, and we tried to point those out in the briefs. I think, for example, factor one, just one point, that was initially intended to just be a simple question. Is the fee periodic, or is it a one-time, one-time type charge when the service is delivered? Beatty seems to suggest that's the end of the inquiry. The Court of Appeals in Missouri Growth says, well, yeah, it's periodic. It is every month, but it's based on services received. We don't argue that water, sewer, and gas are the component that goes to the cost of those services are true user fees. But the inquiry in the footnote just says whether some portion of those fees are going for the cost. So that suggests that if you wanted to increase it by 100%, you could do that under the factors. Well, what happens with the
brings
money.
Brings me to a question. What about all of these municipalities that have retained their municipal utility, but they don't generate anything? They buy their electricity from the local REA. And what if, in the wisdom of the councilman, they want to start doubling their rates so that they can buy wind turbines or redo their generation facility, because while it's competitive now, they're afraid the REA could raise the rates, so they want to redo their plant. In order to redo their plant, they got to double their rates. I mean, that wouldn't necessarily turn it into a tax just because they're forward-thinking, would it?
Right, exactly. I think if you look at the Pace case and the Columbia case, we're not arguing that the rates can have all those factors. You can set aside reserves for rate fluctuations. You can raise money for extension of your system. You know, cost is broader than just the cost of the wholesale rate of electricity. We've never argued anything other than that. But when you look at the component that's the profit, that's the pilot, that's imposed to reflect what the taxes that a utility, private utility, would pay, that's fine and good to have that as long as it's in place before 1980 or you get voter approval to increase it. That's our argument. But you can't, if you have Ameren UE as your electric provider, can the city just all of a sudden pass a legislation and say, we want UE to transfer $100,000 to our park fund because we're a little short this year? No, you can't do that. So why should you be able to do that with your utility when you've got all those costs, you can recover those costs, those are left to your sound discretion, and the only thing that the voters have to approve is the money that's being diverted to the general fund.
Let me ask this, though. Under that analysis, you're really saying you have to separate out each fee into a cost basis and a profit basis. And if the profit basis ever increases, that has to go to the vote of the people.
The rate increases. If it's based on a pilot...
Are you saying anytime the rate itself increases, it goes to the vote of the people, or just the profit portion of the rate?
Excuse me. The pilot portion of the rate increases. In other words, if you go from 5.5% to 6.5% as your gross receipts, that triggers...
So that's a rate increase. I'd say that's a rate increase.
But what if you decide to do that?
No, because that's based on, as a percentage applied to the gross revenues already generated by the utility.
Well, so anytime that happens in any utility, in any city of the state, are we going to have a lawsuit to have a fact-finding then?
No, because most cities, like Columbia and Herman, Hannibal, have a rate that's already established that reflects their pilot. So if they want to go from 5.5% in the case of Hannibal to 6.5%, it's a voter approval, just like in the city of Brentwood or any city we want to pick that has Ameren. If they want to increase the gross receipts tax on that utility, they have to put it to a vote of the people.
Council, I thought you just told Judge Fisher that if the utility wants to raise additional funds because it wants to expand its plant, it could be raising it from 5.5% to 6.5% because it needs it because it's concerned about rate increases or wants to add wind turbines or whatever
right.
It may be. So it's not as simple as you're saying.
With all due respect, what I'm trying to say is when I talk about the 5.5%, I'm talking about the profit component of the rate. They can raise the rate for all the cost components, like they decided.
You're saying that whatever component percent it is that's not used as reserves or to expand, but is used for unrelated city.
Follow the money. If that money stays in the general, it stays in the electric utility and is being used for electrical purposes, we have no Hancock issue. If that money is being raised and diverted into the general fund, and it's evidenced by the transfers that is occurring, that's a Hancock violation.
Let me come back and say then, what happens if a city just says we're going to set up a separate fund for our public utility? None of that money will be transferred to city. It will stay right there. Now, can we raise that rate up and down without any vote?
Yes.
Okay.
And Your Honor, I'm an old city manager, so forgive me, but that's the way all the utilities have their own separate fund. They're enterprise funds, and so they have those monies there. And so if they say we're going to embark on an extension of our system or we're going to go with wind turbines, those are all fine. I think the issue becomes when those monies are transferred from that enterprise fund to the general fund or to other purposes, that triggers the Hancock issue. And I don't think that's a difficult evaluation. I think all the misdirections and mischaracterizations that are occurring in order to try to avoid application of the Hancock Amendment is what's causing the confusion. I think if you follow the money, and if the money goes into the general fund or is being diverted for another service unrelated to the utility, I think it's a pretty simple and straightforward question.
One thing I wanted to ask also is why should the municipal utility be put to the disadvantage compared to, say, a public utility with stockholders or private utility in not being able to make a so-called profit for return of capital, an investment, all the manpower dedicated to that utility, not just in that each area, but also overall by the city itself and its council and so forth, and then also why wouldn't they be able to reclaim what they'd normally get in taxes if it was a public utility or a private utility. In other words, why shouldn't they be able to recover those two components as a reasonable part of their fees?
Again, that was all taking place before 1980. They had already determined what their profit was going to be. In the case of the city of Herman, the natural gas utility, they had a 10% tax on their utility in 1977. They repealed it. I'm sorry, in 1977, they repealed it. And then in 2002, they imposed it again as a surcharge. What you're saying is these local officials have the right and the ability to set their rates. But when they in 1980, with the Hancock Amendment, if they're changing the tax component, the profit component of that rate, they have to go to the voters. The voters are the stockholders. Why shouldn't, you know, you have a rate in place and you want to increase your profit margin? We're not stopping that. You just have to go to the voters and say, look, we've decided that 5.5% of gross receipts is not enough. We want to raise it to 6.5%. That's fine. All you have to do is get a vote of the people. Why are we afraid to have the people decide what the profit is? And again, this is money being diverted out of the utility to fund other purposes, not to fund a sound management of the utility in question.
Are there any further questions? Thank you very much.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
May it please the court. Just want to not spend too much time, but I began my legal career in this particular courtroom 36 years ago, and it's a pleasure to be back. I spent a year with the young men and women in the back as a law clerk, and I have to say, of my 36 years, it's the most memorable moment of my life. And if I never make it back here, I just had to say that. Points I would like to make, and I know it's been briefed extensively, you have lots of brief to follow. The trial court properly decided that the municipal charges are not subject to Hancock, and in so doing, the court followed consistent rulings, not just in Keller, but going back earlier to Oswald and to Zahner, that the holding of Hancock only applies to taxes are fees that are taxes in reality. And I charted 30 Hancock cases that I was able to determine. I'm sure I missed a couple of them, but I believe that their results are consistent. And I think for my esteemed opposing counsel to call the judge's application of those sophomoric is somewhat insulting, because I think the judge properly followed the law. And I think the law is good law. Mr. Opposing counsel says, well, Keller is still good law, but, you know, somehow don't follow it. I think this court's approach in Keller, again, was consistent with prior law. I think Roberts versus McNary was the aberration. I think the Keller tests are insightful. They're pragmatic. They followed the intent of the voters to limit local taxes. I don't think the voters ever had in mind that I'm going to vote on my whether I get a utility bill or not. Utility bills are not levied. People don't open their bill and mail, so I got my utility levy. It just doesn't happen.
Opposing counsel suggests that the Keller factors are very helpful, but they're to help us determine the ultimate issue, which is whether something's a tax or a fee, whether it's, even though not called a tax, is in effect a tax, and that they don't work very well when you have a single supplier of a service, such as here, where it's a utility service. They simply don't get to that situation, and therefore, since their purpose is to help us, the court, decide the issue, whether it's a tax or a fee, we need to add something different or take a different approach. Can you address that?
Well, I agree, and I think we both agree that the five-part test in the footnote is to help you decide, and I think that's what the judge did to reach his conclusion. Does it work well in this case? You know, it becomes a closed case, and it's really hard for me to give you the bright line rule, the definitive rule. I still say that this is not a monopoly environment, that gas...
It's not realistic to say that you're going to make your own utility service in your home, though, and therefore it's not a monopoly, is it?
Well...
I mean, there's multiple kinds of utilities, but you need some kind of utility.
Some kind, presumably, although you don't need gas. There's people, you know, when I was in college, I lived in a trailer where it was all electric.
But as a realistic matter, if 98% of the people in Herman are getting utility service, can you address it from that perspective?
In some way or other. But again, I think they had their choice. Their choice is not only to who to take it up from. They had their choice to sign up, to make their own. They had their choice to conserve, to turn the lights off, turn them down.
Should our decision be affected by whether or not if there's a sole supplier or something that most of the citizens will find to be an essential service? Or is that not relevant to this determination?
Well, again, I think it's certainly part of your consideration, you know, and it is a hard question that you're asking. And like I say, I can't find a definitive rule. But, I mean, if you take the situation of even Keller, which is an ambulance case, well, you know, if you nicked an artery, it's pretty important that you're going to use the ambulance service that's going to come get you. So they have, in essence, a monopoly. If you have a public hospital and you get injured in Eldon, Missouri, you're going to go to the first hospital that's along the line. So there's probably no choice there because
prior cases really didn't think that was a key factor or a dispositive factor. That wasn't whether or not you were the sole supplier in prior cases has not been looked at as a relevant or as an important factor.
No, I think even Zahner, I mean, you have somebody, a special assessment. I mean, what was the choice that the person had when they were making a special assessment for street and sidewalk repair? I don't think it's been the case.
Is it ever relevant how much profit a city would be making from a particular service? Say Herman were funding its entire budget from the fees, or say it made a 300% profit or something that very different than the facts of this case, but how would that weigh in at some point in your mind?
Not as a Hancock violation, but I think there is a law that this court has relied on, that a lot of the court of appeals relied on. I cited the Forest City versus Oregon case, where the courts have equitable jurisdictions to set aside rates that are clearly, palpably, and grossly unreasonable, but that's not what they're alleging. They're saying that there's a Hancock amendment. But I think you could bring an action for an injunction to keep rates, the 300% increase that you said, from going into effect. But I don't think it was the intent of the Hancock amendment, the intent of the voters, to have the taxpayers have to go back and look in the rearview mirror and say that, you know, years ago, in past years, you had a surplus in that year in a particular fund, so it was transferred to another fund that had a loss, or transferred to general revenue to help pay for police, fire, roads, whatever it goes. So I guess that's the best answer I can give you to that question. There is a remedy. There's an equitable remedy, and I think the only sound equitable remedy is that they go for a preliminary injunction, an injunction to keep palpably unreasonable rates from going into effect. And then the other one is...
Also, they could vote out the people who voted for the rate.
That's what I was just going to say. You already raised the point, and that came directly out of Keller. I mean, I think in Keller they said, and I can't find it right now, but they said, it was in Keller. They said, you know, you could vote the people out. We have elections every year in Herman. Half of the board of aldermen turns over every year. The mayor turns over every 2 years. In fact, there's been multiple turnovers just since this case started.
It's a 10% gross receipts tax in this case. Is that correct? That's an issue?
Well, I don't think it's an issue because it predates Hancock. I mean, this was put in effect in the 70s. Hancock didn't start until the early 80s.
You're saying that under opposing counsel's test, which would be if you're raising the percent that you get that you got in 1980, you would still win?
Well, yes, because it was covered under that. And, in fact, the record reflects we've actually reduced the 10% from 9 and then to 8, and they're trying to reduce it even further.
Well, but opposing counsel obviously will have a different take on that. What is their, why do they think that it's a tax and not a fee, and that it does not qualify as a pre-Hancock tax?
I think he misunderstands what the gross receipts fee is for. The gross receipts fee is not profit. What it is, it's payment for the use of the right-of-way. The electric utility goes in and they rip up the street, and then they repair to the street, and then the street's been degraded, and it's going to have to be replaced. It's not going to last 40 years. It's going to last 10 years with the asphalt repair instead of what it used to be in concrete. It's a typical charge that any other utility would pay. The telephone companies have all been deregulated, and they have to pay it. They have to pay it. And so what's wrong with the other utilities properly paying the gross receipts I don't even think it applies to the sewer rate. I don't think there is a gross receipt because they're not ripping up the street. But I think the gas and the electric, they obviously
is there evidence relating the amount of the gross receipts tax to overhead costs that the city has for those kind of items?
Well,
or that it's a reasonable amount to hold in reserve for those kind of items?
No, because I don't think you need evidence, because the gross receipts tax predates Hancock. I mean, it's like Hancock was not intended to be retroactive and recalculate rates back to the beginning of the century.
What if the situation was where the city, we might get into argument as to what's an essential city function, whether they should provide the pool and other stuff, but what if a city tries to raise its taxes to cover what the current Board of Aldermen think are reasonable city functions, and they lose? And the next meeting, they say, well, if we're going to continue to do this, we've got to raise the electricity rates. They won't pass our levy, so we've got to raise the electricity rates. Mm-hmm. If that was the record, would that make it a tax, or under your argument, would it still not be a tax?
Well, hopefully that wouldn't happen.
Well, hopefully they'd be smart enough not to say that. That's what I mean. But I don't know the people on the city council at Herman.
Yeah.
But I've had some experience with city councilmen, and sometimes things like that are said.
You put into words what I was thinking on that. But
Mr. Heinz, I want to direct you to the part of Keller that I think is probably plaintiff and appellant's strongest argument. Of avoiding the factors and just going straight to the question, and that is the part of Judge Benton's opinion where he says, starts out, fees or charges prescribed by law to be paid by certain individuals to public officers for services rendered in connection with a specific purpose ordinarily are not taxes. And then this part, I want you to try to explain this. Unless the object of the requirement is to raise revenue to be paid into the general revenue fund, general fund of the government, to defray customary governmental expenditures rather than compensation of public officers for particular services rendered. That's in the body of the opinion, not in the footnote, and it's I think a main basis of the plaintiff's argument, as well as the ruling Eastern District had. Okay. How do you respond?
Well, again, that language was not essential to the holding in the case, and it actually was a quote from a prior case, and it wasn't the holding in that case either. And I don't know how you would determine what the object of it was. I mean, obviously the object of charging for utilities is to receive payment and provide service. So how is there any other object? Now, I would agree with you if someone came up and said, okay, well, we're going to, I can't even think of a good example, but, we're now going to make people pay a license fee, or I'm trying to think of it, for, somebody, everybody whose name begins with M or something like that. And that, I think, would be a situation where you say, well, that's clearly a tax. But, I mean, the object, there's nothing new in Herman today that hasn't been in effect long before Hancock. And I think that the point that was made about generation capacity, I mean, the city doesn't generate electricity. We don't have any, hydroelectric dam. We don't have a nuclear power plant. The city does not generate gas. It buys it from somebody else. So the genesis of this debate, and the plaintiffs have not pleaded anything about any particular raise taking place. They're just saying, in a rear-view mirror aspect, looking backwards, there were some transfers made, ergo, there was too much money in the fund. And I think the problem is that Mr. Mello's got too much of his old city manager hat on, and he's simply making this a financial accounting debate. It's really a theoretical debate. It has no no reality to a city of 2,000 and some residents. I mean, you know,
what is in the record about how the rate was set and what the city of Herman did and how they went about setting this rate? What do we know from the record?
Well, I guess I'd answer that by saying that the record is that the ordinance was passed, the electric ordinance, for instance. I'll read that to you. The electric ordinance, I'm not going to read it to you. I'll just tell you what it says in my mind. The electric ordinance, that is the genesis of the debate. I don't think there was any problem with sewer. I don't think there was any problem with water, refuse, and gas. Everything was perking along fine. The problem with electricity is that their costs skyrocketed. They lost the advantage in the mid-2005 of some very good contracts. And they had some huge expenses. Their Route 19 went down, and they had to spend $2 million rerouting the power lines and the gas line. They had to run the gas line under the Missouri River.
So is there evidence that you're sort of out of time. So is there evidence that the increases in rates went to pay for past expenses or anticipated future expenses? Because opposing counsel would say it went over to pay for other unrelated costs of the
city. Yes, the electric ordinance that is part of our motion for summary judgment is attached, recites that costs have risen and the city is basically getting less from electric ratepayers than the city is paying its supplier. They're underwater. So was there a transfer? Yeah, there was a transfer. The gas loaned some money to the electric because gas had some reserves. Electric had used up all its reserves.
There's something in the briefs that says that the the money gained from charging for utilities pays for 35% of the general revenue budget of the city and budget in other areas. Is that, do you contest that? Or
no, I think that's misleading because, first of all, the big component of the transfers were the payment in lieu of tax, the 10%. I mean, 10% of the billings for electric and gas is a fairly large sum. And again, this predates Hancock. So then it gets down to what are the other transfers, and there were some minuscule ones. Some were loans that were paid back. You know, the city has gone to the voters this year. They've had sewer revenue bonds, a $4 million bond issue approved by the voters. They've had a new parks and recreation tax that was approved by the voters this year. The city isn't trying to avoid this. But the plaintiffs have not pleaded any ordinance that increased a tax levy. There's absolutely none in the record.
Can you address Chief Justice Price's question? Is this a question of fact before us that we give deference to the trial court's findings, or is it a question of law, the application of that, or a mixed question of law and fact?
Well, as I said, I think that their pleading reveals that this is not a Hancock case. That this, if they want to bring a lawsuit to bring rates to attack rates that are going into effect, they can do that. They have their remedy, judicial remedy. The Forest City case and a whole host of cases, there are Supreme Court cases on that as recently as 2004. And they do have their electoral remedy to bring that into case. Other than that, I would say that the judge, you know, properly had the facts in front of him, and if the court was right on any basis, he should be sustained. I wanted to touch one issue. Opposing counsel used, you know, this Hollywood cliche of follow the money, suggesting that the money went to Venezuela or something. It didn't. Whatever surplus went to the citizens. It went to the citizens and the taxpayers of Hermann. The investors didn't get it. Ameren, the investors get, you know, the profits on it. They get payment on their bonds and that. The mayor doesn't get anything.
Isn't that true of many things that are covered by the Hancock Amendment? That in fact it does go back, but it's just Hancock places the decision as to whether it should be raised and benefit the citizens. And they place the decision it with the citizens rather than with the governmental officials.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that is true of a lot of Hancock issues, but I don't believe this is a Hancock case because it's not a tax. And it's not a tax in under the guise of another name. The things that go into the rates include, and I think the court's mentioned some of them, you have your cost of service because we don't generate.
Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Okay.
Your time's expired.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, I know I went over my presentation for to answer questions, but I would appreciate it. Ask for a couple minutes to respond to just a few points.
Sure.
Thank you. My first point would be that to remind the court that in its 1994 decision of Beatty versus MSD, this court stated that the Hancock Amendment reveals the voters' basic distrust of representative government to keep its spending and taxes in check. And that doesn't mean anybody's a bad actor. It's just the propensity of the beast, and that needs to be controlled, and that's the purpose of the Hancock Amendment. Everything could be fine in Hermann, and the people could be fine with their rates. All they need to do is vote for it when the rates are being increased for general government purposes. The second point I would make is that all the utilities that we're talking about are statutory monopolies. They're all regulated by the Public Service Commission except for where the municipality is providing that service. I think that's a pretty clear distinction between that and other services that we're talking about. The point that I would also like to make is that I said it inartfully, that I didn't mean the judges were sophomore. I meant that the I'll save that for opinion for somewhere else.
At least you didn't say freshman.
But what I meant to say was that the test is sophomore, that the footnote test is sophomore, because it doesn't go to the heart of the essence of Keller and Zahner, to follow the money. We're not arguing, again, I think they want to obfuscate our argument. We're not arguing that if you have a utility fund and you raise all kinds of money and you raise the rates any way you want to and you're using it and that money stays in the fund and being used for expanding the electrical service, that's between the people and their elected officials. The Constitution of our state, though, requires a vote when you're increasing the amount of the charges and that and
a portion. Opposing counsel said they had a 10% gross receipts tax prior to 1980.
I implore the court to look at the record. In 1977, the city repealed its 10% gross receipts tax on gas. That was their decision to make. 1980, the Hancock Amendment.
What about electricity and all the others?
Electricity was 10% in 1980. It was reduced by the exercise of the sound judgment that they're defending of the Board of Aldermen to 5%.
But,
in 1982.
But for Hancock purposes, don't we look at what the rate was in 1980?
Not if you reduce the rate, because in a city that had a tax rate higher at one point could always go back to that higher rate without voter approval. Once you reduce the rate, that becomes the new bar. And so then when you raise it back up again without voter to people, you're imposing an additional rate on the residents.
So you would say it was sort of by utility. Natural gas, you got to take it to a vote. Electricity, it might be okay. Sewer, different.
Again, our fact inquiry, to go to Justice Price's question. It's a fact inquiry about follow the money. If the money stays in the general fund, and I'm sorry, in the utility fund and being used for utility purposes, we don't have an issue.
What about opposing counsel's argument that city streets are torn up, the trucks damage streets, other kinds of things, and normally you allocate the taxes you get from a utility for that kind of cost, but you don't put it in a separate fund for that because it's the streets used
exactly.
by everyone.
Exactly, and I appreciate you reminding me of that point. And again, I hate to be an old city manager, but those were factors that were in existence prior to 1980, so it shouldn't have been a surprise to somebody.
But they're costs.
They're costs, but they're reflected in the pilot payment that the city imposes. But the city doesn't have to impose a certain amount. They've decided that this is the amount they need for their profit, for whatever street repairs they want to make. Or they can do it.
But why are street repairs profit? Why aren't they costs? I'm not clear.
They're costs, but they were already built into the rates as of 1980. They were repairing streets before 1980. It wasn't a new cost that was discovered.
So, but I thought the difference is if it's for cost versus for profits, whether or not they were already recovering
from
that.
No, I'm trying to go past the labels. They're talking, because they call them surcharges, they call them profits, they call them pilots. If you look at the cases, they're all different labels. The fundamental essence, though, is are they being transferred to the general fund for use for other governmental purposes?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Making it very hard for the city of Herman to own a bank.
What?
Never mind.
Case is taken under submission.